Our second speaker this morning is James Conyers. He's a graduate student in the first doctoral program in Africana Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. And he'll be reading a paper by Molefi Kete-Asante, who is the author of Kemet, Afrocentricity and Knowledge.
Hotep. Dianet Kanku Jusumi Mirajet. That means may you be given life, prosperity, and health like Ra forever. Let me repeat again. My name is Brother James Conyers, and I am a student, PhD candidate in the Department of African American Studies at Temple University. And I'm very, very honored today that I was chosen by Dr. Molefi Asante to read his paper. It's a great honor for me, and I hope I can do it some justice. Let me just also say that if I should kind of fall by the wayside a little bit, just clap your hands a little bit, wake me up. I'm very tired. I haven't slept in over 24 hours. So just kind of smile or do something to wake me up. So with your permission, I'll read Dr. Asante's paper. Malcolm X on Culture, an Afrocentric Location by Molefi Kete-Asante. Culture is a product of the historical processes which lead to self-conscious recognition of the defining characteristics of how human beings respond to the social, political, and economic realities of their environment. Afrocentrists understand culture as more than a surplus of material growth because it is fundamental to national self-assertion. Indeed, it is the basis of sustainable material value. Throughout African American history, we have borne witness to men and women who have deeply interpreted the meaning of culture and who in their words and actions have demonstrated their understanding. Malcolm X was preeminently a cultural spokesperson, a culture person, and an analyst of culture. It is the intention of this paper to examine Malcolm within the context of his own time and within the framework of the African American situation for African Americans. I am particularly concerned with how Malcolm interacted with his community in order to create a more revolutionary response to cultural domination. Malcolm's identity as an intellectual and organizer must be seen in the light of his emphasis on people transformation. He expressed it in his concept of a radically different African-American person. Quote, he is the new type. He is the type that the white man seldom ever comes in contact with. And when you do come in contact with him, you're shocked because you didn't know that this type of black man existed, unquote. Culture contains the power to assemble behaviors, modes, customs, symbols into a single, comprehensive, affirming presence. It is Malcolm's posture towards self-hatred, culture-side, and menticide that governs his cultural ideology. Speaking of the operationalization of his affirming posture, Malcolm says, quote, this new type rejects the white man's Christian religion. He reorganizes, he recognizes the real enemy, that Uncle Tom can't see his enemy. He thinks his friend is his enemy, and his enemy is his friend. And he usually ends up loving his enemy, turning his other cheek to his enemy. But this new type, he doesn't turn the other cheek to anybody. Generations are often the engines of cultural and technological innovation. The end of the Second Great European War saw the beginning of a new generation. Malcolm X, having been born in 1925, reached the zenith of his cultural and intellectual powers during the 1960s. However, one can say that he began with his conversion to the Nation of Islam during imprisonment, announcing a new concept of culture. With the age of Malcolm X, a new epoch began in the conception of a national culture, causing a far-reaching revolution in the traditional views held by members of the African-American institutions. Malcolm was not merely, quote, our manhood, but the keeper of the ancestral flames of a proactive response to human conditions. His life represents the rebirth of the extensive African-American commitments to cultural reconstruction, which are not yet concluded. Despite the various political and social contours of the past 20 years, we have not yet succeeded in wholly realizing the fundamental cultural vision of Malcolm X. This is certainly not to say that we have been asleep because the revolutionary social ideas of Marlana Karinga are directly related to the Malcolmian project. What is necessary is the consistent and persistent dissemination of the ideas Malcolm espoused in regards to culture, essentially a, quote, pattern or the habit of seeing ourselves, hearing for ourselves, thinking for ourselves, and then we can come to an intelligent judgment for ourselves. Yes, sir. Starting to get into it a little bit. Malcolm X saw that the adaptation of our attitudes, language, motifs, ethos, history, and aesthetics to the social and cultural imperatives of the African-American people in America was the first requirement for a comprehensive cultural transformation. There could be no other interface with our historical destiny. We had to center ourselves in our African reality. A long list of precursors contributed to Malcolm's pattern of growth. The doctrines of Elijah Muhammad had an early impact upon his thinking, but he later flourished in the richly textured world of Paul Robeson and Marcus Garvey. That's a good world. Perhaps it was his father's association with Garvey's movement that prepared him to accept the more concretely personal teachings of Elijah Muhammad. African culture, already present in the thinking of the nationalists, gained respectability with Malcolm's pronouncement that we were Africans despite all of the claims of the African establishment in America. He knew that the word African had come to have a negative meaning to most Africans in the United States, so he explained it as a matter of cultural misorientation. Quote, the word African was used in the country in a derogatory way, but now since Africa is getting its independence and there are so many independent African states, the image of the African has changed from negative to positive, unquote. The concept was pregnant with cultural possibilities inherent in the historical ground of our social and political reality. Others before Malcolm had recognized the power of this truism, but never with so much force had it been impressed upon the people by an African-American who understood the implications of cultural revolution. Garvey, Blyden, Delaney, all in a chain were the progenitors of Malcolm's maturity on the cultural question. For the first time since Garvey and the expressed symbol of Africa as a powerful instrument in cultural awakening, the cultural attitude revived in the rhetoric of Malcolm. Here it came as a torrent, breaking the shackles of a genuflected people and announcing a new, more aggressive approach to cultural reconstruction. As we heard him and sat at his feet, it was inevitable that his faith would be reflected in our numerous attitudes to restructure our response to America. Thousands of urban Africans reached toward Malcolm's vision, and when it was comprehended, preached in Shangoian voices the truth that they had seen. Furthermore, with Malcolm's challenge that we were Africans, it became clearer that, quote, Negro was dead. In the struggle of ideas where cultural considerations were seen as primary, that is, fundamental, the old Negro order, hailed in its day by Alan Locke and others as the new Negro, was permanently laid to rest by Malcolm. No one could be taken seriously without a response to the shocking posture of his discourse. Malcolm brought discontent within the camp of the old order, creating by the power of his logic schisms in the conservative body politic of Africa America. It is easy to understand the preeminent position of Malcolm as a cultural figure when in addition to all I have said, we consider the intense reaction of white American establishment to his call for black cultural nationalism. Malcolm was considered an extremist and a militant by most of the white press. Of course, the African-American press, itself often tied to the white press corporate structure, was hardly any better on Malcolm. The cultural epic of Malcolm, of course, wears a multifaceted umbrella under which walks a new woman and a man born of cultural struggle and understanding Karinga's notion of history as a struggle and record of humans in the process of humanizing the world, shaping it in their own image and interests. Even now, the legacies we have inherited from Malcolm are the most dominant motifs of our approach to humanity. Since culture involves struggle and struggle developed culture, Malcolm understood the necessity of the African-American to recognize value in our culture, in our traditions. Malcolm made an end to the apology of the Negro and declared that we would be free by any means necessary. While we often understood Malcolm to include self-defense, we know from his teaching that he was committed to changing the way we thought about ourselves in Africa. Planting the seed of an affirming African presence, his cultural project was the root from which would grow strong, vital African sentiments and attitudes. Malcolm's project gave the impulse to the cultural nationalism that exists always just below the emotional surface of every African American. Along with this impulse to cultural nationalism, Malcolm's project encouraged the ethical value of Afrocentric institutions. Thus, the cultural epic initiated by Malcolm developed very quickly into a thousand parallel universes of freedom which stood against the sacrifice of Africanity to some abstract concept of integration. What Malcolm X strove for was the dispelling of illusions because illusions were not based on African centrality. Culture, to be meaningful, had to be Afrocentric. The meaning of Afrocentric culture. Reconstructive culture was understood by Malcolm was fostered by social responsibility based on the understanding of history. Such responsibility in the context of the African American community could only exist on the basis of cultural solidarity. What Malcolm understood was the need for mutual appreciation of Africanity as the first level of overcoming oppression based on physical or mental brutality. The appreciation of Africanity is the same as self-acceptance. When this prerequisite is absent, there is the possibility of what Azibo refers to as extreme misorientation. Malcolm was a cultural worker in his most elementary manifestation. His aim always was to collect the people into a community of solidarity so that the new cultural energies would arise for the common purpose. In the creation of community solidarity, he wanted to establish a national consciousness which would render ineffective the old Negro order. His language characterizing that order is well known. Malcolm says, quote, "Also, this type of so-called Negro, by being intoxicated over the white man, he never sees beyond the white man. He never sees beyond America. He never looks at himself or where he fits into things on the world stage, and it puts him in the role of beggar, cowardly, humble, Uncle Tomming beggar on anything that he says is that should be his by right," unquote. Malcolm's view of culture was centered principally on an Afrocentric foundation. He did not assert and would never assert the development of the national culture as the result of an economic necessity. He never tried to prove, nor would he have been so inclined to prove, that historical events were always caused by economic necessity. In reality, Malcolm was an astute observer of the historical conditions of the African American, and he saw that in the serious reconstruction of African American culture, the struggle for power, the ability to create categories which are accepted by others, frequently played a much more important role than economic necessity. Beyond this, however, was his insistence on African American cultural autonomy, by which he meant all things considered cosmological, axiological, epistemological, and aesthetic. Given such autonomy, it was possible to imagine a culture of resistance as well as a reconstructive culture. By virtue of its affirming posture, this new view of culture became, in Malcolm's theory, a critique of oppressive reality. This critique was presented in Malcolm's rhetoric as a missile against the enemies of African American people. Indeed, his language was complete as the expression of national culture. More so than Langston Hughes in poetry or Martin Luther King Jr. in civil rights, it was Malcolm who elevated the people street language to a national style. Few passages in the history of oratory can compare with the straightforward logic, dynamic cadence of Malcolm saying, quote, "So when I come here to speak to you, I'm not coming here speaking as a Baptist or a Methodist or a Democrat or a Republican or a Christian or a Jew, not even as an American, because if I stand up here, if I could stand up here and speak to you as an American, we wouldn't have anything to talk about. The problem would be solved. So we don't even profess to speak as an American. We are speaking as I am speaking as a black man," unquote. Indeed, one might argue that Malcolm's ground of contact with the people was so vast that his groundedness with the masses so profoundly human that he earned the title spokesman in a manner wholly unlike any other African-American leader. He was not spokesman by virtue of his official status within the African-American community, but spokesman because he actually spoke what was in our hearts the way we would have spoken it if we had been so eloquent. Language is never the invention of individual people, but rather the creation of a community as a whole. Culturally, Malcolm tapped the most creative aspect of African-American life, drawing upon the proverbs, the folklore, the nuances, the syntax, and the grammar of the people's creation to make his own discourse. Between his discourse and ours, there was hardly any difference. He spoke, and when he spoke the words right out of our mouths. Yes, sir. A discourse on reality. Malcolm's discourse was African-American cultural expression, which changed with the economic and political conditions of the United People. This special form of speech, a rap tune of protest and action, enabled African-Americans to reach for higher moral and political results. Speech became for Malcolm like a dance, polycentric and polyrhythmic. In reality, Malcolm X on culture was predictable. He could not have lived as an African in a racist society without wishing to come to terms with the contradictions of place. Racism is everywhere the same in its objectives, in the selection of its arenas of struggle, and in the means of attack. Its devastating impact on the intellectual, economic, and cultural life of Africans in America is everywhere revelatory. Malcolm knew, as others had known, that its effect on any people led to the same horrible effect, the stripping of self-esteem and the creation of a population of consumers of a hostile culture. All anti-American attitudes which exist in a racist culture become, if there is no corrective, the attitudes of the Africans. In such a situation, the culture derived from Africans is considered secondary to the culture of the oppressors. Malcolm knew this process through his own personal experience and recognized the many-sidedness of the resistance. Indeed, it was necessary to build a culture of resistance, to strengthen African self-concept, and to struggle for a liberated community. Malcolm, even with his great cultural commitment, did not stand aside outside of space and time. He was bound to the past, the present, and the future. What is significant in his genius is that the voice that creates a unified and directed discourse which may have lain dormant in the masses. Thus, Malcolm's cultural idea is a universal idea based upon what preceded him and projecting what would succeed him. This cultural picture opens to Africans a refreshing outlook on life. Human beings are collective beings who are dependent upon predecessors, and therefore no one can really draw a line between what he or she has acquired by his or her own powers and what has been received from others. Every cultural idea, whether it be a political, social, or spiritual nature, has forerunners without which it would be inconceivable. Therefore, to truly understand Malcolm, we must understand him in the context of his particular time and space. As heir to resistance, nationalism, pride, knowledge, and nobility, it was destined that he would be a culture person as well as a teacher of culture. Perhaps his most authentic legacy to us is in his fulfillment of the prerequisites of what it means to be cultured in our terms. Being cultured. The criteria for culture derived from the actual life of an African-American, of the African-American people are contained in Malala Karenga's seven constituents: history, mythology, ethos, motif, social organization, political organization, and economic organization. Those criteria constitute what Donna Richards called the Utabubu wa Kutazama, African philosophy and worldview. Malcolm X walked in these criteria stronger than most public figures because he embodied, indeed, self-consciously embodied, these criteria in historical thought and language. For example, Malcolm's speech to the grassroots conference held at the King Solomon Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan, in 1963 employs history to place the audience in the shoes of revolutionary and counter-revolutionary persona, transforming his audience into Bang-Dung delegates, French revolutionaries, Russian peasants, field niggers, and betrayed black men. The heroic Malcolm champions African culture as the only corrective for an extremely misoriented people. Malcolm's cultural position might be seen as self-conscious intervention in misorientation. An African-American had to know that he didn't come here on the Mayflower. Furthermore, the sane African knows he was brought here on a slave ship. But this 20th century Uncle Tom, he'll stand up in your face and tell you about when his fathers landed on Plymouth Rock. His father never landed on Plymouth Rock. The rock was dropped on him, but he wasn't dropped on it. To be cultured in the traditional African manner carries with it the responsibility to use language effectively. In his historic persona, Malcolm is the master of the cultural element. Numerous studies on Malcolm's ability to communicate suggest that his power was so elemental and essential in his efficiency that his voice remains unanswerable, fluid, pure, and fundamental. The best of our oratorical genius converged in his heroism, and we were always left with the feeling of having been in the presence of our purest self. When Malcolm X spoke, his images were perfect. The cadence of his sentences was like poetry, whose rhythmic structures hark back to the profound African sensibility of a people victorious against a million agonies. So full of his culture, it was as if he knew everything about us and wanted to teach us by sharing the depths of our experience. Malcolm could juxtapose singing and swinging, landless against the landlord, grassroots versus grass leaves, house Negro versus field Negro, and a black march on Washington versus a Negro march on Washington. While the philosophical core of Malcolm's relationship to reality is not an antistic duality, Malcolm demonstrated that our condition in America was fraught with extreme danger. Therefore, he postured the one against the other, the good against the evil, the African versus the diabolic, as an instructive device rather than a philosophical statement. In the end, it is natural for him to show us the unreality of Hollywood and the basic reality of Harlem. The point is not lost on an audience of believers. Perhaps the principal clue to Malcolm's understanding of culture emerges when he demonstrates his rationale for action. The struggle against the condition of oppression, for us, culture has no other practical end. It must be the regaining of freedom in order to be truly effective as humans in history. He had arrived at his analysis of the role of culture, by which he meant all of the seven constituents later conceptualized by Karenga as an Nguzo Saba, through testing the historical choices made by the African Americans. The civil rights movement came under extreme close scrutiny since it had galvanized thousands and captured the imagination of the black establishment. What Malcolm discerned, however, was the ineffectiveness of a movement which did not address the cultural question. He spent his life asserting this theme and the very implications of this theme. If some found his theses violent, it was because he had laid them down without excuse and because the system of white domination of African Americans was violent. What more could he do than present a direct challenge to Africans in America to take up arms and march into battle? How else does one approach a sustained physical and psychological assault? What else is real? Thus, Malcolm had gained his own sanity and was located in an Afrocentric mode before he broke with the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, teachings that had been a major bulwark against the indecencies of white Christianity. Elo has written of Malcolm's rhetorical challenge to African-American government in this way, quote, "The only useful attack is directness, which opposed to outrage is outrage, and to apologies of outrage, outrages." Malcolm's cultural consciousness exalted resistance to outrage and became, by virtue of his commitment to the survival of his own culture, a key aspect of his nationalism. Quote, "And the motto of the Organization of Afro-American Unity is by any means necessary. We don't believe in fighting a battle we don't believe in fighting a battle in which the ground rules are to be laid down by those who suppress us. We believe that we can win in a battle where the ground rules are laid down by those who exploit us. We don't believe that we can carry on a struggle trying to win the affection of those who for so long have oppressed and exploited us," unquote. On another occasion, Malcolm could ask African-American community leaders questions like the following. Why should whites be running the stores in African-American communities? Why should whites own all of the businesses in African-American communities? I guess we can ask that question about a few others today, can't we? Malcolm's questions were unanswerable by the black leadership of his day. He destroyed Roy Wilkins' logic that though the black man was a second-class American, he was still an American with a powerful rejection. "I'm not going to sit at your table and watch you eat with nothing on my plate," and call myself a diner. Sitting at the table doesn't make you a diner unless you eat some of what's on that plate. "Being here in America doesn't make you an American. Being born in America doesn't make you an American," unquote. This passage, like so many of Malcolm's passages, shows him to be one of the most accomplished orators of his time. Indeed, the Oxford Union Society considered him among the best of living orators after he debated under their auspices about 3 months before his death. Always amused at the unreason of his opposition and assured of his own cultural and moral recessitude, Malcolm taught us the most majestic element in our defense was not meanness of spirit, but magnificent nobility of African culture derived from our traditional African philosophical roots. One reason we listened to him was what Kariamu Welsh Asante calls the virtue of recognition. Malcolm resembled us at our best, in our most authoritative manner, in our humanity, in our style, in our humor, in our secrets, and in the manner of our treatment of each other. And these things collectively, with specific qualities, we each could individually admire Malcolm. Admire Malcolm's life as a testament for African-American culture. While we must admit that Malcolm resembled us in our highest cultural reality, he was also our cultural teacher. Creating a curriculum of culture from our own history, he elevated the art of instruction by serving as a model for what he taught. If he taught us that courage was more rewarding than cowardice, he demonstrated by his own life that he believed what he taught. If that government was full of tricksters, then African-American leaders should not have coffee with the tricksters. He met the protectors and defenders of the establishment only to tell them of the grievances we held. Thus, culture for Malcolm did not subscribe to a reception theory of culture, but rather he promulgated the view that by any means necessary, we had to advance from the oppressed state in which we found ourselves in America. The broad dissemination of this message alone was sufficient to create for him a place in our cultural history because no one had ever taught quite so effectively, so directly. Malcolm's cultural path will not be complete until it is fully realized in the active political and social lives of African Americans. In the end, that is the only authentic test for his conception of an Afrocentric culture. He becomes a figure transformed in the actuality of our own historical experiences. Thus, to live Malcolm, as some African Americans in Philadelphia and other places have begun to do by making him an Orisha in the Yoruba sense, is only one aspect of culture. He is represented by a string of solid black beads. However, the reality of Malcolm at his best, at the level, does not and cannot replace the need for authentic confrontation at another level with oppression, menticide, self-hatred, and exploitation. Thank you very much. Hotep.